listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Hello, thanks for downloading the show. I'm Rob Daly, your host for Football in Europe. This week, loads of great stuff. We have Spanish football writer for The Times, Joe Casanelli, on to talk about the brilliant title race in La Liga. We've got some audio from a road trip I took last Friday to see the Nord Derby, Hamburg against Werder Bremen. At Hamburg, I went with BT Sports, Archie Rintat, so we're going to bring you that a little bit later on. Don't forget to tweet us at FIE Podcast if you do enjoy the show, much like Austin Lung. He says, enjoyed all the Portuguese coverage last week with Tom from Portugal.net. And please leave us a review on iTunes as well if you do have the time. Bolton Monkey, leaving us a 5 out of 5, saying, great podcast, enjoyable and informative. Certainly makes the walks with the dog much more enjoyable. Love the detail there, Bolton Monkey. Chris Parrott's with me. Chris, hello.
Hello.
You're back, mate. You were away last week.
I was away, yes.
I feel like I say this every other show. Where were you?
Sorry, I was in Germany last week. And I am going on a holiday this week, so I won't be here next week.
So, hold on, you're not here next week?
No.
So I need to get another person in?
Yeah, I'm really sorry about that.
I'm paying you all this money.
I know, exactly. And, you know, and I mean, we have seen the ratings dip enormously when I'm not on it. So I do apologise.
That's not true. It's our highest listenership for a long time last week. Chris, you know, I went through a stage of saying, yeah, baby, to you. People might know this, but when we would record the podcast on a Monday, once we'd finish a segment, I would say, I don't know why I really got into saying it. How did you like me saying it to you, or did you find it offensive?
No, I quite enjoyed it. And the problem is then I started saying it to other people. But there was absolutely no context to it.
Well, I'll ask you this because someone's left us a review on iTunes. Simmons for Prez says, yeah, baby, boss. Which makes me think that you wrote it, but you didn't write that.
No, it wasn't me.
Oh, I didn't do it. bit self-indulgent, the opening here. But let's move on. Let's talk about Jurgen Klopp.
Being self-indulgent.
Let's talk about you speaking to Jurgen Klopp. Because obviously he's Liverpool manager. But I think people will be very interested to hear. Because you sat down for, what, half an hour with him? Did a sit-down interview for UEFA.com and for the Europa League TV show.
Yeah.
That was at Melwood. And obviously in the lead-up to the Villarreal semi-final, which we'll get onto later. What was it like to actually get... like a sit-down interview with Jurgen Klopp?
That I felt privileged. He is a totally infectious character. Mm. He said during the interview, I don't really have a footballing philosophy, and that people say it's gegenpress or it's this or that.
But the heavy metal football thing.
Yeah, so he said, I regret saying heavy metal football all those years ago. I don't know why I said it. I was a young guy. He came across as an unbelievably normal person. I mean, that sounds boring, but because he's not. But no sort of massive mind games or anything like that. And he said that his main thing is that if he walks into a room, he wants to leave it a happier place, which sounds a bit wishy-washy.
Sounds a bit David Brent, actually.
It does sound a bit Brent, yeah. But it was true. He came in. You know, he's the star. You never quite know what mood they're going to be in, how that's going to impact.
I mean, some of those sit-downs with managers, I mean, we've both done them. They can be absolute nightmares.
Yeah, so and he walked in the room, big beaming smile, shakes everyone's hands, and you just thought, okay. That. And he did. He immediately set the tone. And it felt like that's what he's demanding of everybody at Liverpool. He spoke about why Liverpool, it was very clear in his mind, it was, you know, it is similar to Dortmund. It's a big... huge European global club, but actually the sharp end, it's quite a, you know, people who have worked there for a lot of years, and that idea of him I think having control about everything and everyone then gets behind it, and it's that watertight club. Maybe the most interesting thing, so we spoke about the second leg against Dortmund, the quotes are out now. It went out on BT Sport the weekend. So he said in the morning after, it was completely different, because usually after a game like this, you wake up and you think, oh, great, what a wonderful thing. And he said, and this time I wasn't in the best shape, to be honest. I had no real idea why. And then it hit me. Yes, they lost.
The Dortmund lost.
So during the game, around the game, I was completely concentrated. But the next morning, he said, I can't do his accent. He said, I knew how they felt. I knew how Dortmund were at the hotel. So, you know.
Because he knows all those guys, basically.
Yeah. Delighted that Liverpool are through. don't take this the wrong way. He wants to win the Europa League. But nice, you know, like in anything, that he had 7 years there.
And you felt that was a sincere answer, not a contrived thing.
Not contrived. Totally sincere. Didn't have to say it. You know, could have just been like, yeah, well, you know, I was there. But as I said, that...
I found it very interesting during the game, because when Liverpool were coming back into it, his celebrations were mad. Mm. And I thought, God, he really wants this result. Not that you'd ever question that. But then when the winner went in, his reaction wasn't quite the same. It was almost disbelief and all the rest of it, and he just sort of stood still. And I wonder if all these things were going through his head as well.
So I asked him that. He said the reason for that was it was shock.
I was shocked, right.
It was
right.
Shock. Yeah. And I asked him why he does what he does on the touchline. And he said, I don't really know what I'm doing. And then he laughed and he was like, it's not a controlled necessarily. It's just, that's him.
We've not seen him get angry yet, have we?
No.
Because he can fly off the handle.
Yeah.
But you know, officials and stuff like that.
It's quite nice in, you know, I think sometimes in football now, you know, even when you see players speaking to each other on the cameras, they do that thing when they hold their thing over their mouth. As if, you know, they're, I don't know if it's paranoid, whatever it is, because of 24-hour media. But he was just, there was none of that.
He seems a bit like an open book.
Yeah, there wasn't any of that. And it was very refreshing. Yeah. And that came about, that answer, when he just said, honestly, I don't really know what's happening with.
And what does he think? I mean, we'll get on to the Villarreal tie, but does he think they're gonna win? Liverpool are favourites.
Yeah, I think he admitted they were favourites. He also knows that, you know, they are a very good team. But after these two massive games, I mean, maybe the biggest games the Europa League has seen, Manchester United, Liverpool, Dortmund, Liverpool in two rounds.
Absolutely, yeah.
Very quick to say that, look, this is a semi-final. And he pointed out himself, he has a fantastic record in semi-finals and not the best record in finals.
So he said,
hopefully that will continue and then he'll have to improve. And if they get to the final in Basel, win that.
Okay, Chris, let's talk about this four-year-old ultra. Now, I've not shown you this yet. This is a four-year-old girl called Paula. I feel like I'm telling you a nursery rhyme or something. Four-year-old Paula. And she started this footage doing the rounds from a Spanish YouTube account.
She's called Paula.
Paula the Ultra. She's adorable. This is for Spanish second division side Alcorcon. So I'm going to play you the audio now.
Paula sounds like a 65-year-old from Barnes.
So basically Paula has a megaphone at the moment and you can hear her. She's chanting in front of a big group of like the ultras at this second tier club in Spain. And this is the best bit when they go a bit mad. Chris, come on. That's cute, isn't it?
Very cute.
That's very cute. Terrifying at the same time.
We don't know what they're saying, of course, but
yes, we don't speak Spanish, so
no,
apologies.
It's better than I thought it was gonna be. She's just standing there with a megaphone. Not sure she's got any idea what's going on. But that is great. And then she goes into the dressing room as well.
Yeah, she does it for the players as well.
This I mean, is good.
Yeah. So she's really at the heart of the club.
I wouldn't call her an ultra.
Bit strong.
I mean, she just looks like, you know, but that is, I suppose she is. Ultra, it doesn't necessarily mean what we think it is, like trouble and things. It's
I don't know, she might have beaten someone up after the game, you know.
But I imagine her dad is the proudest guy in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no doubt. Because, I mean, we don't see young fans getting too angry too often. There was one you were talking about before that is a favourite of yours, a young fan who...
Yeah, Feyenoord. We'll speak about them later in the show, but that kid who's on his dad's shoulders, sticking his middle finger up.
It's quite old, isn't it, that picture? Like, kid is so young in that photo. We'll tweet that out if people can't remember that photo.
The kid's really young.
It's iconic, though.
And because the wonderful world of the internet now, they've got a picture of this, of him now. Or, well,
no.
Yeah, like, or it might not be now, but 10, 15 years, and he's with his dad. They've both got tattoos on their forearms. And they're just,
oh, God. They're looking, that was always going to happen, wasn't it?
They're looking equally as menacing. But, I mean, whichever cameraman caught that photo of the kid with his middle finger up,
I bet he was so happy.
It's just in one, never has one face just told the story. It's so good.
I mean, I'm impressed with the four-year-old starting to chant, but I remember being in the away end at Bramall Lane for an Ipswich game. where you started a chant and caught on and all the Ipswich fans. I was in awe of you for about a month after that.
What, you mean you're still not?
No, absolutely not. Yeah, that was also a game where everyone was ridiculing James Beattie for being fat, and I think he's got a hat-trick in Ipswich.
That's the absolute classic. Yeah. You do that as an away fan. Oh God, he scored.
Okay, so from the most lovable video of the week to perhaps the most nauseating. Chris, I've not shown you this yet either. This is AC Milan played Carpi last week, and before the game, a group of actors dressed up as the AC Milan squad came out on the pitch and did this. So you can hear that they're doing, the actors dress up as AC Milan players on the pitch, and they're doing like a hacker, sort of like the New Zealand rugby team. But it's basically a viral thing for like a cosmetic brand that we won't name because that gives them a little bit of success. But rather than some of the steps of the hacker, you know, you slap your thighs and all this, they're sort of rubbing fake deodorant under their armpits. Thoughts?
No, put it off. I don't want to see it.
It's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'll tweet that out as well, but
that
is grotesque.
It's also pretty offensive because the hacker is, it's a war dance before sporting contest now, but it's a historical thing, isn't it?
People thought that was actually the AC Milan squad. Can you imagine persuading them to do that? Absolutely not.
It's been dreamt up in somebody somewhere who's probably paid a lot of money.
In a boardroom have dreamt that up.
Put it off. I don't think. Maybe we should cut this out of the thing because we haven't mentioned the cosmetics company.
We've not done it yet. No. FA Cup semi-final.
Yes.
Let's talk about this very briefly. We're not an English football podcast, but Anthony Martial, you were commentating on the FA Cup semi-final. Manchester United won over Everton. I'm sad to say I've not seen any of this game. Everyone was raving about it. But Martial, the star man, and something we talked about at the start of the season, he's having been, he was like 50, 60 million quid from Monaco and rising, depending on how he does for the club. Apparently, he was absolutely outstanding.
Well, I love watching him play. I think he's only 20. David De Gea played his part as he always does. He's such a good goalkeeper.
As good as Neuer?
Yeah, for me.
I think he is now. It's insane.
He is pretty much faultless a goalkeeper at the moment. But Martial, he doesn't always make the right decision yet, but he's only 20. I mean, the way he just beats people on the wing and then the composure to finish in the last minute to stop it going to extra time. He is, there was a lot. And I think we had the guy on who wrote the report because the Mirror famously had a back page. Which...
Yeah, that was earlier in the season on Football in Europe. We had Esteve Calzada, who used to be, I think, the chief operating officer at Barcelona. It was great to have him on, but he had written this report about young players and said that Manchester United effectively had overpaid by triple or quadruple for Martial what he was actually worth. They reckon he was about £16 million.
Yeah, but he also admitted that it's... That was what they had priced him at, but there's so many other variables in football as to why. And that I always thought that because Anthony Martial for Manchester United, just they getting him into the football club, you know, they have a fairly big financial clout and he's so important to them that I don't really know how you can price someone. Do you see what I mean? It's maybe had he gone to somewhere where he wasn't going to be first choice, you would have overpaid if you paid that much money, but if he gets them into the Champions League, for example, or he
that's worth tens of millions alone,
you know,
isn't it?
And if he's there for 10 years, then all of a sudden that fee isn't very much. And he is such an exciting talent.
Better on the wing?
Difficult to say because he finishes so clinically when he gets a chance. It'll be interesting to see where he does end up. I think he can play in either. And, you know, he's going to go to Euro. He's going to start for France. And...
They might need a striker with no Benzema. Yeah, they might need a...
That's a global stage, but he just beats people. I haven't seen a player when he gets one-on-one, when everyone creates the space for him to get one-on-one with a fullback who, you know, beats people so often, so consistently.
Let's talk about German football next. As I mentioned last Friday, I went to the Hamburg Werder Bremen derby, the Nord derby, and here is our report from that game.
This is Football in Europe, Match Day Road Trip.
I am in Hamburg with Archie Rintat. It is a Friday night, and Archie, it's derby night.
It is, but usually they don't play Hamburg against Bremen on a Friday night. It's only because the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama, He's in town in Hanover, which is also in northern Germany, on Sunday. And because of the policing requirements, it's meant that this game has had to be played on a Friday night for the first time in the 21st century.
Yeah, do you want to just explain what bar we're at, Archie?
Okay, so it's called Unabsteigbar, which is a pun which doesn't quite work in English. Unabsteigbar literally means in German, unrelegatable. And it refers to the fact that Hamburg have never been relegated since the Bundesliga started back in 1963. It's the sort of place where the hand dryer is hanging off the wall, and yet there's quite a lot of loud German music kind of pounding out through. But you've still got a healthy amount, or an unhealthy amount if you're a Werder Bremen fan, of Hamburg scarves decorated around the bar, along with some second division football, which is currently on the telly.
So this is a big game, not just because it's a derby, but because Hamburg, somehow having been mid-table for much of the season, are in the relegation fight again. And this must upset Hamburg fans.
Exactly. If you look on the front page this week of the Hamburger Morgen Post, Hamburger Mopo as it's known, you will have seen earlier this week that quite a few Hamburg fans still fear the prospect of a third consecutive relegation playoff. And the fact is, for the majority of the season, they've not looked like being anywhere near that. But now, at the last minute, Werder Bremen, who are currently occupying that relegation playoff spot, are only 3 points off Hamburg. They could effectively drag Hamburg and a whole lot of other teams into it today. Hamburg, though, have not done the double over Werder Bremen, so they won the first leg of this back in the first half of the season. Hamburg have not done the double, won home and away against Werder Bremen in the Bundesliga since 1968.
So we may witness history. Let's go speak to some Hamburg fans and see what they think about being in the relegation fight again, and their thoughts on head coach Bruno Labbadia.
Typically for Hamburg, whenever the opponents play well for us, like they lose and we could win and make a big step to the top or
and be safe.
Yes, be safe. Then we lose. It's always the same. Today it's like a 6-point game, because if we win, Bremen is 6 points away. If we lose, we're even. Like, both have, I think, 34 points.
What is a bigger derby for someone who's not been to this derby before? St. Pauli, when St. Pauli are in the same league, or Werder Bremen? What's a bigger derby?
I would say it's Bremen, because St. Pauli is always second league team for us. They don't belong in the first league. When they are in first league, we want to win, of course, and we hate St. Pauli, but we know they're going down. Bremen is... It is history. It's like so many games against Bremen. That's definitely the biggest derby. And
Bruno Labbadia got a new contract in January. Is he a good coach for Hamburg?
I think he's not the best coach, but he's really good when it goes to motivate the players. When it's against the relegation, then he finds the right words to motivate the players. When it's not against the relegation, I would say they're better trainers.
I'm Alexander. I'm supporting Bremen, but don't tell anyone here. Considering like the positions of both teams in the German table right now, it's one of the biggest derbies they probably had in the last decade, I guess.
Why have Werder Bremen been involved in the relegation fight this season?
They just screwed up, I guess. I mean, they haven't done a good job. They perhaps
because last season was good. Last season was good.
I mean, it was fine, but they probably should have swapped their coach a couple games ago. They didn't. I think everyone's excited, actually, to see Hamburg and Bremen going head-to-head.
In terms of German football, so you have Dortmund, Schalke, and you have all these other derbies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where does it rank?
I mean, the thing is, unfortunately, looking at Hamburg and Bremen, they've been on the lower side of the table in recent years. But considering that, it's one of the biggest top three derbies, basically. You have Dortmund, Schalke, of course.
Yeah.
And I think then Bremen-Hamburg is right up there, yeah.
Okay, cool. And tell us about Claudio Pizarro, because he's come back. He's 37 now, is he 37?
Yeah.
And he's scored 11 goals. How important is he to the football club?
He's more like a metaphor than is actually... I mean, of course, he makes goals, but for Bremen, he has... turn basically of the spirit of the Bremen fans around. There is hope now, basically, with Claudio.
So would you want him to have another year? Do you want him to stay?
Oh, hell yeah, of course. That's what everyone is hoping for in Bremen.
It's the evening after the Nord Derby. Me and Archie are on the train back into London, having flown back home from Germany. Hamburg won the game 2-1 against Werder Bremen. A big win for them. Probably means they're safe. Would you say that?
Yes. Unequivocally. Werder Bremen back on 31 points now. Hamburg on 37 points. And the fact that Bremen now have a big game next weekend against Stuttgart, who are just one place above them in 15th, means that one of those is going to take points off each other. Therefore, you would say that is either of them going to really catch Hamburg? They'd be exceptionally unfortunate with quite a few sides below them still in the table.
There was a moment, Archie, where we were doing the, I think they call it the Derby Walk, hashtag Derby Walk, from the train station to the stadium. I'll just play the audio of this now and we'll work out exactly what was going through your mind. So that was a flare that went off in the tunnel as we were walking down. You were a little bit scared there, mate.
I was. It was a very bright red flare, and it was very loud.
It was so loud. That was like, I didn't know what had exploded.
I mean, the fact that there was no alcohol allowed in the stadium and that was banned because of previous infringements meant that, yeah, perhaps it wasn't quite as enjoyable after we reached the ground in that regard.
We talked about the game after. We ended up sitting with Werder Bremen fans. We didn't know that's where we were going to be sat.
That should be mentioned as well.
That should be mentioned, that I booked the tickets and somehow ended up in the away end. But you felt the derby didn't necessarily have the intensity that you were expecting. Would that be fair? And was that down to the alcohol ban?
No, I think the Hamburg fans were certainly well up for it. I think that you do need an away end, though. It's almost like you have a hive. Bear with me on this. You've got a hive, and the hive is the home stadium. And you need someone to run up to that hive with a massive stick to hit it. And the people with the massive stick are the away fans. I think the early goals took the sting out of it, but also the fact that the Bremen fans, the ultras, weren't there because of wanting to bring a few things into the stadium that they weren't allowed to, and indeed wanting to have a fight. The police held them back. So our reliable friend next to us in the Werder Bremen fan end told us that they were on their way. They weren't, because the police held them back.
That's something we've seen in the paper the next day, that they were stopped on one of the motorways up to the stadium.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that maybe had an impact right on it, but you can't say that the alcohol ban completely affected. You don't know. I think it maybe played a role in terms of one of a few factors.
This weekend, elsewhere in the Bundesliga, Bayern haven't quite wrapped up the title yet. They got a 2-0 win at Hertha, and Dortmund won 3-0. So it goes to, they're 7 points clear, and in theory they should win it next weekend.
Next weekend they need one more win. They're playing at home against Borussia Mönchengladbach, but you look at their final three games, they only need 3 points now. After Mönchengladbach at home, they go away to Ingolstadt and then finish at home with Hannover. There is no chance that Bayern are not going to wrap up the Bundesliga, if not next weekend, given how bad Borussia Mönchengladbach's away form's been. Then after that, it's all sealed. I think that the thing to really look forward to now in the German domestic season is what both sides secured, i.e. the top two secured during the past week. That German Cup final on the 21st of May Berlin, Borussia Dortmund against Bayern Munich, and that comes 1 week before the Champions League final as well.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
Big thanks to Archie for coming on the podcast again. It was a very enjoyable weekend in Hamburg in the end. I also commentated on Wolfsburg being beaten 2-0 by Augsburg at home. It means Wolfsburg probably won't even be in Europe next season. Amazing, really, considering they got to the Champions League quarterfinals. And remember, only narrowly lost to Real Madrid thanks to Cristiano Ronaldo's hat-trick. Chris, I want to tell you about Max Kruse, though.
Yeah.
So he's had some issues this season. Number one, he was in the tabloids for being addicted to Nutella. Addicted was probably a bit of a tabloid term, but Klaus Allof says he has to improve his diet. Then it was revealed he left a load of money in a taxi after a poker tournament.
Berlin, was it?
In Berlin. And then the last one was something to do with a very private, intimate video. Very intimate. yes. of Max Kruse. Since then,
moving swiftly on,
one goal in 18 league games. He was the striker that they. Well, he's not really a striker, more a forward attacking midfielder they brought in from Gladbach last season. And I tell you what, the weekend, Chris, he looked psychologically shot. He gave the ball away in the first 45 seconds, which led to a goal. He hit the bar when he should have scored, and he just kept giving the ball away. And you know, it's amazing. We look at Valbuena as well this season, Chris, about how his personal life has impacted on his playing. And it would appear to be the case with Kruse. I mean, what would you do in that situation?
He's not going to Euro, is he? Jogi Löw's pretty much said that.
He's in a foul mood with him.
Yeah. So I just hope, because he is a very, very good player. I mean, he was Gladbach's main man as they qualified for the Champions League last season. He's 28. You know, maybe summer off if he is mentally shot, which it sounds like he was.
But most summers he heads out to Las Vegas and plays poker.
Well, yeah, I mean...
So he'll have to not do that.
Yeah, because I think if he does, I mean, I would imagine every German tabloid will be following what he does in the summer.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
But I just hope that he can have a couple of months off and come back and be the player that he is, because... Yeah, I really like watching him play, Max Kruse. I think he's a fabulous talent.
Okay, Chris, let's move away from Germany now. Do you fancy a little quick fire round here? I've got some notes here on things I want to talk about.
Yeah.
So tell us about the French League Cup final. Go.
Paris Saint-Germain won it. So they're on course to win every piece of silverware again. Already have the league wrapped up, of course. It was tight against Lille, though. They won 2-1. Javier Pastore put them ahead. Sidibe equalised, then they got Rabiot sent off, and you thought, well, maybe this is the moment that someone else wins something in France, but Angel Di Maria got the winner, and so they won 2-1. Another piece of silverware, they're in the French Cup final against Marseille, which is going to be, what a night that's going to be in Paris.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there are so many rumours about Laurent Blanc's future after he was knocked out of the Champions League by Manchester City, and whether even winning the treble or the quad, if you count the Charity Shield, would say.
Which we don't. Jonathan Johnson said the other week on the show that if Blanc doesn't, the minimum is he has to win every trophy. Mm. Now, he has to win both cups, and he's done that. He's halfway there. Serie A, Chris, what's going on? Everyone's playing. We're recording this on Monday, and everyone plays today because it's a bank holiday, really. But a couple of fixtures from the weekend.
Yeah, Juventus, huge win away at Fiorentina, who remember, were top for a little bit of the season,
they
Fiorentina.
Were, yeah,
and they've dropped away fairly spectacularly, in all honesty. But Juve winning 2-1, and they can win the title. Their fifth straight Scudetto, if Napoli don't win away at Roma, which is...
God, that might be done by the time this even goes out.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. That's a huge game, because it's second against third. You feel if Napoli get something and maintain at least the five-point gap, they'll go into the automatic Champions League place, and Roma would have to qualify if they can then fight off Inter for third spot. But Juve, I mean, for their start of the season, to be talking now before May that they can wrap up the title. Max Allegri has turned their campaign around.
That's brilliant coach, brilliant coach. And obviously Napoli come up against a Roma side that have an informed Francesco Totti with this two late goals in the win against Torino midweek, which sparked amazing scenes at the Olympico. Chris, Dutch Cup final. Tell us about this one.
Feyenoord won, beat Utrecht, 2-1. That famous club picking up the trophy. It was in their own stadium, which I don't know if that... Well, it definitely helps.
That definitely helps.
I was going to say, does that help? But yes, it
especially
does.
Especially when it's that stadium.
Particularly
as well.
Particularly when it's... one of the most atmospheric grounds in European football. So Feyenoord have won that. They, you know, had that awful run of form, which, you know, they're now 20 points behind Ajax and PSV, given it was a three-horse race for a bit of the campaign in the league. So, yeah, they won by 2-1. An own goal settled it 15 minutes from time. So Feyenoord have some silverware to end the season with.
Yeah, Giovanni van Bronckhorst, the head coach there. Chris, so much entertainment in Belgium. They averaged...
you don't normally say that, do you?
No, John O'Driscoll, who produces the Belgian highlight show, actually tweeted me to say, you do know that there was an average of 5 goals a game this weekend. And things are really interesting there at the moment. Club Bruges are top by 3 points. They beat Zulte Waregem 5-0. The league breaks up into like three mini leagues. It's like absolutely mad in Belgium. But Club Bruges at the moment, 3 points clear. Anderlecht losing 4-2 at Oostende. Apparently there were crowd riots in that game as well. They've had a lot of that trouble in Belgium, haven't they?
By the way, everyone in Belgium wasn't bothered with the football there at the weekend. It was Liège, Bastogne-Liège, one of the biggest cycling races.
Oh, here we go. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, the whole town of Liège comes to a stand. So you go, the race goes past the football ground, and check this out.
Okay.
It snowed.
Did it? It snowed in April?
It looked miserable. So they had to change the route. I mean, not just a little bit of snow. Thick snow.
All right, would you rather cycle over snow or cobbles? As a little callback to an earlier show.
Oh, dear. Cobbles.
Still cobbles.
No, I'm not very good in the cold.
All right, let's talk about Russia now, Chris, because we're both working on the Russian Premier League. We had a tweet in from Connor Brown this week saying he likes it when we cover the smaller leagues. And I suppose Russia's one of those that doesn't get as much coverage, despite the fact that their teams perform relatively well in Europe. But at the moment, Chris, and we talked about it before, the Russian Leicester Rostov,
yeah,
might be about to win the title in one of the most unlikely title wins in Europe this season.
Yeah. Commentated on their game yesterday, it was seen as, they've got 5 cup finals to come. Still 5 games to go, by the way. It finishes later than almost every other European league. They played Zenit, the defending champions. It was first against third at the start of the day. Siska, who we'll get onto, and Lokomotiv both won. So it was second against fourth by the time it kicked off, which shows how tight it is. And this team who survived in the relegation playoff last season, 1-3-0. They hammered Zenit.
3-0?
3-0. They frustrated them to the point of which Hulk was just trying. I mean, he always tries mad things. But he was trying cross-field passes from almost inside his own penalty.
Was he shooting from 40 yards and all that
they
nonsense?
They just had no way of getting past them. This team Rostov, who under Kurban Berdeyev, who won the title twice with Rubin, the only time since the breakup of the Soviet Union that it hasn't been a Moscow team or Zenit who have won the title. And he might be doing it again, Rob. And just to put it into context, they had the worst defensive record of anybody last season. They haven't conceded a goal since November.
Say that again. They haven't conceded a goal.
Since November.
No.
I think it's 8 straight clean sheets. Yeah, we've had the winter break in that time, but 8 clean sheets.
Oh, so this is a bit like Leicester.
So in fairness, it's the first time I've watched them properly on Sunday. And you think, oh, is it just because of the story that they're called Leicester? They play an unbelievably similar style. They press, they work phenomenally hard. If anyone gets the ball, there's always someone, you know, like Kante or Drinkwater, there's someone on them. And they're clinical in front of goal. They don't have many chances. Invariably, they take them. They have this tight, compact ground. They have a team spirit. They even do a post-match huddle. They do a half-time huddle.
Do they?
Yeah, everyone seems in on it. They have a highly respected coach. They have players who maybe have been, well, they have been discarded by the so-called bigger clubs, and they've all got together and they're doing it. And top, they're only a point ahead of Siska, but top two is Champions League football.
But they're heading for that. Problem for them will probably be that Zenit and the Moscow clubs will gut their talent because they've got more money, surely.
Well, I don't know. This sounds, because Leicester definitely have talent, you know, but whether many of their players would get poached, I'm not sure, because a lot of them are 30, 32.
Oh, the Rostov guys, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, they do, you know, they have a striker up front called Azmoun, who's from Iran, who, you know, has played well. But they don't have any what you'd call total stars, so maybe not. And just to put it into context as well, maybe it's more impressive than Leicester, because for a lot of the season, their players haven't been paid. So they it's financial problems and things. It's been going on for years at Rostov.
How on earth are they top?
Exactly. So they even boycotted a Russian Cup match earlier this season.
The players did. They chose to.
So you're talking about, I mean, everything's against them. Zenit can spend millions and millions.
And they did in January. They Zenit spent a load of money bringing in Russian internationals.
Exactly. So, you know, backdrop of all of that, and yet they're still top.
Amazing. I did commentate on CSKA Moscow beating Dynamo Moscow in a Moscow derby, not the big Moscow derby in truth at the Arena Khimki. Alexei Berezutsky with the only goal of the game. So they won 1-0 and they were top for, 2 hours was it or something like that? Yeah. So Rostov are top by a point. I want to talk about Dynamo very briefly, Chris, because actually they're being threatened with relegation. They're just above, they have a relegation playoff spot in Russia where 13th and 14th play each other and one of them goes down. They've had to, they were banned from the from Europe because of breaching financial fair play. And I was looking at the list of players that they've had to let go or sell in recent times. Here are some of them. So Yuri Zhirkov, people remember, used to play for Chelsea. And Alexander Kakorin, linked with Arsenal and one of Russia's best strikers. Then Balashudjak, Vanker, who's at Roma. Yusupov's gone to Zenit. Matthew Valbuena to Lyon. Kevin Karanyi went back to Germany. And Douglas as well. And guess who came off the bench for Dinamo?
I think I know.
Go on.
Is it Big Pav?
Pavel Pogrebniak didn't come on. Oh. Someone even bigger than him. Chris Samba. Chris Samba is still there. He came on. He looked so rusty. It was like he was made out of old clock parts. It was amazing. And Dinamo needed a goal. They were 1-0 down. They had one sub left. So they brought on Chris Samba.
It's fantastic.
It was mad. It was his first appearance of the season. He hasn't played since May for Dinamo. So, I mean, I'm surprised. He must have been one of those who were trying to flog.
Yeah.
Because he'd be on a fat contract.
Did I also see that Dumbia turned up at half-time?
Oh, he turned up. Seydou Dumbia. Shouldn't he? What is he doing in Moscow?
Very good point.
So he's on loan at Newcastle from Roma. He was a big hero at CSKA Moscow. And he came out half-time, got a wonderful reception, was all smiles. Meanwhile, Newcastle are getting sunk in the Premier League.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Is it? But I was Googling. I can't work out if he's injured or just not being selected or if he's just... I don't know. Sorry, we're not that well researched. but okay, have we done with the Russian League? Are we happy with that, Chris?
Yeah, I think we finished when you said Chris Samba's made of rusty old clock parts.
Okay, let's talk about Spain.
This is Football in Europe, La Liga latest.
Okay, to finish off the show, it's time to talk La Liga, perhaps the most exciting of the big leagues at the moment. And joining us, Spanish football writer for The Times, Joe Casanelli. Joe, thanks for coming back on the show, mate.
No worries, happy to be here.
So you're speaking to us from a travel tavern in Villarreal, I understand.
Yes, it's very Partridge. It's probably the only hotel that actually exists in Villarreal. I think Liverpool fans might be in for a shock on Thursday if they're expecting a party town. Then I think that they might have to think again.
Okay, so we'll get on to that game very shortly. Let's start by talking about Gareth Bale. He bailed out, to use a pun, Real Madrid at the weekend against Rayo Vallecano. You're at this game, Joe. So can you tell us the story of how he saved the day?
It was quite a strange afternoon, really. It was absolutely hammering it down with horizontal rain in Madrid, which, you know, for mid-April is, late April is quite strange in itself. And Real Madrid just really did not look up for it at all. You know, there's the phrase, can they do it on a wet, windy night in Stoke in the Premier League? Well, this was a soaking Saturday afternoon at Vallecas, and Real Madrid's Galacticos were really, really not up for it. They were completely bullied and outplayed. Within the first quarter of an hour, they were 2-0 down to Mino's Rayo Vallecano, who was sitting perilously close to the relegation zone. You know, the place was bouncing. The atmosphere looked like it had got to them, and they just kind of had slumped shoulders. And the only person who looked as if he was, you know, up for doing anything until Lucas Vasquez came on with an enforced change at the stroke of half-time was actually Gareth Bale. He dragged them back into it. He made it 2-1. And then with the scores at 2-2 with about 10 minutes remaining, capitalised on a defensive mistake, a bit of a slapstick defensive mistake, really, but he still had to put the ball in the back of the net, and it's exactly what he did to win the game for his team.
Joe, there's all this talk about when Ronaldo ultimately leaves, whenever that is. And I've seen Bale being considered as then the main man, and would Real Madrid ever build the team around him? Was this evidence that maybe he is the guy to do it, because there was no Ronaldo, there was no Benzema in the team?
Yes and no, really. It's quite difficult to take it just obviously on the back of one game, because you have to take into account the opposition, Rayo Vallecano aside, who, you know, they play very nice, easy on the eye football, but also they play sort of, as I said, slapstick football at times. You know, if you can find a video of the winning goal, watch it. It's a through ball from one of Rayo Vallecano's defenders to Gareth Bale. It's absolutely ridiculous. So you have to take into context the opposition. However, Gareth Bale, You know, there's been a lot of talk of him not stepping up to the plate in big games, but of late, you saw him against Barcelona, he had the goal ruled out in El Clasico for sort of unknown reasons. You know, he's stepping up to the fore, which is really good. The one thing you have to say is that the sort of quantity of goals that Cristiano Ronaldo scores, Gareth Bale hasn't shown he can do quite yet. That's the one thing that you'd have to worry about if they were going to build the side around him. The goals would need to come from somewhere, and I don't think Gareth Bale is quite that prolific goal scorer.
But good news for Real Madrid regardless, going into that Manchester City tie in the Champions League. I mean, Joe, it's one of the biggest games in City's history, a European Cup semi-final. How do you see Real Madrid shaping up going into this one, and are Madrid favourites for you?
Madrid are definitely favourites. Obviously, you know, with the club's history, they've won the European Cup 10 times, are seeking it for an 11th time. They are definitely the favourites, however, and they will be riding the crest of a wave. They've obviously dragged themselves back into the title race. At one point, they were 13 points behind when Gerard Piqué headed Barcelona in front in El Clasico, and they're now just 1 point behind Barcelona. So obviously, they've got a lot of momentum. However, I think Manchester City, there are weak areas that Manchester City can get at Real Madrid. Sergio Aguero is a world-class forward, and with the likes of Pepe and Ramos not enjoying their best seasons and some of the defending that Real Madrid actually put on Saturday, there is hope there for City as well. I think it's very evenly poised. I think it's going to be a game of fine margins.
Talking about the title race then, Barcelona have having let everybody back in, hammered two teams in a week, and Luis Suarez with 8 goals in that time. What's changed, or was it just a blip for Barcelona? And do you think they will now go on and win the title? I know it's a very tight race with Atletico and Real Madrid.
Well, with Barcelona, it's quite strange in that they've managed to score 14 goals in 2 games, having lost, you know, a few on the bounce, which is ridiculous. However, it's almost like all the chances that they missed in those other games have just come back and they're being paid back in the games against Deportivo and Sporting, because they didn't play badly, for example, against Valencia. They in fact played very well. It's just that they just couldn't finish anything. Okay, they were bad against Atleti in the Champions League, but it was just Barcelona. They haven't really changed too much. It's just that they've taken their chances. Obviously, you said Luis Suarez has scored 8 goals in 2 games, which has helped, because before that, he would sometimes looked like he was playing with his boots tied together, which, you know, he's capable of both the sublime and the ridiculous. And I do think now they just won't let it slip. I think that their running is quite an easy run-in as well. They've got Betis away, and then they've got Espanyol at home. Obviously, Espanyol, their local rivals, and would like nothing more than to upset the apple cart. And I think if that game were away from home, they would have to worry. However, I can't see Barcelona slipping up from here on in. I think the one thing you have to say is that Atletico Madrid will be kicking themselves that a couple of weeks ago, before the international break, they were 1-0 up at Sporting, who Barcelona have just beat 6-0. They were 1-0 up away at Sporting with about 10 minutes to go and contrived to lose that game 2-1. Even if they'd have managed to hold on for a draw, they'd be top of the league now and would probably go on to win La Liga.
Yeah, very good point. Talking of Atleti then, Diego Simeone did another mad thing at the weekend. He's an incredible coach, but he does some odd things sometimes too, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think Diego Simeone, he gets caught up in the moment, is probably the best way to put it. He's one of those coaches who he's very emotional. He lives absolutely everything that his side does. And with Malaga racing away, sort of with a quickly taken throw-in, because in La Liga there's obviously the multi-ball system, a ball had sort of been hoofed into the stands, and everyone was kind of looking up in the stands at where the ball had gone. A ball boy gives Malaga the ball very quickly, which, I mean, Simeone probably wouldn't be that happy with his own ball boy doing that anyway. Malaga take a very quick throw-in, and one of their players is racing away down the left-hand channel, which is the channel closest to the dugouts at the Calderon. And Simeone sees this, and, I mean, far be it from me to insinuate what he was saying to the ball boy. However, he appears to request that the ball boy nearest to him throw a ball onto the pitch in the direction of the Malaga player who's sort of running forward like a gazelle down the left wing.
It's genius.
Yes, it is genius. However, he's staring a 3-game ban down the barrel.
Is he? Three games?
And he might miss the rest of the season. Yeah, I was reading last night.
I suppose it's pretty bad, isn't it? It's not great.
I was reading last night. There is actually a rule for this in Spanish football in the rule book, and it does constitute a three-game ban if found guilty. And the video evidence doesn't look great. Albeit, Simeone's defence could probably be, I didn't throw the ball onto the pitch.
I've seen some other quotes today. Joey said, it was the boy beside me who threw the ball, but that doesn't mean anything. I thought he said it was the boy inside me, which I think is probably more accurate.
That as well. That is quite accurate. He does live it, like I said, he's a fan as well as a coach, but he'll do anything for his team. You know, you've seen the way that Atletico Madrid play football. They're very streetwise, they're very savvy, and this is just another example of it. It'd be interesting to see if Arturo Vidal or Robert Lewandowski are breaking free on Wednesday at the Calderon if he does the same kind of thing.
One day he'll end up slide tackling the player. How do you see this game with Bayern, Joe? Because a tremendous performance from Atletico to get past Barcelona in the quarterfinals. Bayern offer a similar prospect in some ways in terms of calibre of attacking players. Do you expect to see a similar Atletico performance, and how do you see the tie going? Because I think you're at the first leg of this one.
Yeah, I'm going to the first leg in Madrid. It's going to be an interesting matchup of styles, like you said. It'll be quite similar in a way because Barcelona dominate the ball. Obviously, Pep Guardiola's Bayern Munich are very much of that mould. They like to dominate the ball, like to have possession. And Atletico Madrid are quite happy to let other sides have possession. Even when they're at home, they like to sit back and then hit on the counter. They've obviously got very quick forward-thinking players in Fernando Torres, Antoine Griezmann and Yannick Carrasco. They're going to try and play a very similar game as to what they did against Barcelona. I think Atleti, you know, they, like Real Madrid, have dragged themselves back into the title race. I think that they did have a 9-point deficit on Barcelona at one point as well, and they've won their last five games. They've done everything that's been asked of them. They've knocked Barcelona out of the Champions League. They've only lost two of their last 29, I think I'm correct in saying, at the Calderon in European club competition. So it's quite a formidable record that they've got, and they will fancy their chances of taking a narrow victory. However, they were dealt a blow in that Diego Godin has been ruled out of the game, but Jose Maria Jimenez will come back into the side and replace him, and his return couldn't have been better timed.
Joe, the atmosphere from watching it on TV seemed absolutely incredible at the Calderon against Barcelona. If we can talk about Valencia now, because obviously Gary Neville left, which was the big story in the UK. How have they done since? Because they seem to have risen up the table fairly spectacularly.
Gary Neville left and then things went right. It sounds harsh, and you know, I'm sure Gary Neville did the job to his best of his abilities. However, the man he got into to help him and be a conduit between the players and the staff, Paco Ayestarán, obviously Rafael Benitez, his former right-hand man at Liverpool. He obviously spoke both English and his native Spanish. Well, he's taken over from Gary Neville, and despite he lost his first game, ever since then, Valencia are undefeated in four with three of those victories. They showed great character and spirit to come back against Getafe. They were away, they were winning 1-0, but then went 2-1 down, and with a late flurry, managed to get a 2-2 draw against Getafe. And they're up to eighth in the table. Now, they're obviously not going to get a European place. However, they're finishing. You know, at one point, it looked as if they won for a relegation battle as opposed to a top half finish. So Paco Ayestarán has done a very good job since he's come in, and would probably be the favourite to stay on for next season.
Yeah, he's done a great job. And Valencia up to eighth in the La Liga table. Hard to believe. Joe, as you're in Villarreal and Liverpool take on Villarreal later this week, let's talk about that game. You're going to be at El Madrigal for the first leg of this one. For Liverpool fans who haven't seen anything of Villarreal, and they were impressive run to the last four in the Europa League, who are their key men and what's their style of play, and what do Liverpool have to be wary of?
Well, Villarreal have been described in some quarters as a kind of Atletico Madrid light, which is a compliment, to be honest, as you've seen how well Atletico Madrid are doing. Well, they're fourth in the Spanish table. Admittedly, they are 20 points behind Real Madrid in third, which indicate, you know, shows the kind of gulf in class between the top three sides and then the rest. However, they are, this season at least, the best of the rest. They are almost certain to finish in a Champions League place, or at least a Champions League playoff place this season. Their star man, obviously English fans will be familiar with, Roberto Soldado up front. And then there's also Cedric Bakambu as the striker, who has got electric pace, and he'll be looking to run in behind defences. Last night, they did draw 0-0 with Real Sociedad in a very uninspiring game, but he was very lively. They've also got Denis Suarez, who's an attacking midfielder, who's formerly of Manchester City and Barcelona, who's been linked with a move back to Barcelona this summer as well. He's got a lot of pace. He's got a lot of tricks up his sleeve, and I think he and Bakambu will be the two danger men. The only thing that you would say that does go in Liverpool's favour is that they haven't actually managed to win in their last three games. They lost away to Rayo Vallecano, then they lost away to Real Madrid 3-0, and they only managed to draw last night. So they scored once in their last three games, which isn't great form going into Europa League semi-final. So I'm sure Jurgen Klopp will be taking heart from that and hoping to keep another shutout.
Joe, just to finish, for you, how disappointing is it that Divock Origi doesn't play, obviously injured with that really nasty tackle from Funes Mori in the Merseyside derby last week? His form seems to have coincided with Liverpool's improvement. Despite the fact that Daniel Sturridge is scoring, how big a loss do you think it is that Divock Origi is not available, likely for the rest of the season, judging by what Jurgen Klopp's been saying?
Yeah, well, I mean, you never want to see any player get injured, let alone a young player, do you? And it was, you know, it was an unfortunate tackle, I'm sure, that Ramiro Funes Mori didn't go out to intentionally hurt the player. However, it didn't look great on second viewing. One thing that Villarreal's backline isn't the tallest backline, and obviously Origi's improvement, you know, you've seen that he's muscled up, he's been an aerial presence, he obviously scored a header in the Merseyside derby, and I think his presence as a big man who is able to hold the ball up and bully defences will actually mean that he is quite missed. I think he would have been perfect for this game, right, which is unfortunate for him. It's one thing that a couple of my colleagues and I did comment on last night, that from crosses, Villarreal weren't, you know, they are Atletico light, they're not Atletico, and Atletico from crosses will generally head them away all day and have either Diego Godin or Jose Maria Jimenez ready to just, you know, head it 50 metres down the pitch with some sort of miracle header. However, Villarreal haven't quite got that. They're a shorter side, which, you know, and then Christian Benteke also isn't fit for Liverpool. However, I think in the second leg at Anfield, if Liverpool were needing a goal, it wouldn't be a bad option to throw him on up top, because apart from, we've got Eric Bailey, who I saw in the mix zone, who I imagined to be taller. And when you imagine a footballer to be a bit taller, then, you know, he's maybe not on the... I'm not calling him a short man. He's obviously not short, but he's just not the tallest for a centre-back. So I think that Origi would have had a good time against them. And unfortunately, he's not going to play. Daniel Sturridge is obviously a different kind of player, a quality player. And
Benteke. Is this where this is leading? You'd start Benteke?
I wouldn't start Benteke personally. I would definitely start Daniel Sturridge. However, I think the option is always there if you need a goal, or if you can see the centre-backs are struggling, if you want someone to kind of act as a battering ram. Jurgen Klopp always has that up his sleeve.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us on the show again, mate. We really appreciate having you on.
No worries, happy to do it anytime.
Okay, that's all we have time for on Football in Europe this week. Chris, how can people get in touch with the show?
Well, your number is 079...
No, don't do that.
So many options, Rob. At FIE Podcast on Twitter, or you can go to iTunes, and please do leave us a review. We really appreciate them.
This is Football in Europe.